Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our final look at the life and crimes of Gary Heidick. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. You can find me on most social media platforms under any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just like my friends Channel Anthony, Robert, Debbie, Samantha, and Jason have done. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off on the last episode, Sandra Lindsay had just succumbed to the various abuses that Gary Heidick was inflicting upon the women who were his captives. And Heidick had taken things to the next step by feeding parts of Sandra to his captives as well as to his dogs, going so far as to keep parts of her body inside of the freezer, her head inside of a pot on the stove, and her rib cage in a dish inside of the oven, which led to the neighbors complaining. We also discussed how Deborah Dudley continued with her rebellion against Heidick, and he had brought her upstairs, and that when she came back downstairs, the other woman would later tell the police, she was shaken and completely quiet, and that after a period of time, Dudley confided to them that he had shown her Sandra's head and asked her if she wanted to end up in a similar condition. Following all of this, the women stated that Heidick did not come down on the evening of Sandra's death demanding sex from them, and it was a few days before he resumed his normal activities, but that once he did, the stink of burning human flesh was so strong that they nearly vomited whenever he was in the room. Heidick begins to become paranoid at this point, believing that the women are plotting and planning against him and instituting basically a snitch system where the women will be encouraged to rat each other out in order to gain favor with Heidick. And if they refuse to do this, he will beat the one who was left in charge. We talked a little about this last week. He had instituted something similar to this prior to Lindsay's death. However, with Lindsay's demise, he really kicks it into full gear. And in fact, one of the captives takes full advantage of this. This is Josefina Rivera. And this is going to lead to some legal repercussions for Josefina later down the line. As she would later tell police, she was learning how to manipulate Gary, and she was using this ability and the trust that he began putting in her to build up his confidence that she was really with him so that she could escape and rescue the other women. Others have contended that she had begun to enjoy what Heidick was doing and became a willing participant, while a third camp has said that Josefina Rivera was in fact suffering from Stockholm Syndrome,
similar to what Patty Hearst went through with the SLA back in the 1970s, where she was taken captive by them and ended up becoming an unconscious supporter of what they were doing because the experience was so traumatic for her. Her brain basically shut down and went into autopilot. Now, sometime towards the end of February, Heidick decides that the best way he can keep the women off balance is if they do not know where he is. And as they reported, he came downstairs and would take them one by one, with the exception of Josefina Rivera, handcuff them by one wrist to the eye hook in the ceiling, handcuffed their ankles, stuffed plastic bags in their mouths, and then put his arm around their throat to restrain them further before proceeding to jam screwdrivers in the women's ears in attempt to deafen them, only stopping when pus and other fluids began to come from the women's ears. Thankfully, though, of the women who survived, from all of the records I've been able to locate, none of them in fact suffered any form of permanent hearing loss. However, you can see that Heidick is becoming much more sadistic in his treatment of these women, and he does this for the rest of the time that they're in captivity, where he'll be, you know, exceedingly kind to them, and then he'll revert to just being an absolutely awful, sadistic, and violent creature towards them. And some have speculated that this may have been due to the schizophrenia that he was supposedly suffering from, while others have contended that this was a way that he had concocted to keep the women off balance, never knowing what to expect from him. At some point around the time that Heidick performed the screwdriver trick on the women, he got the bright idea that it would be sexually stimulating if he began to introduce electrocution into his various sexcapades. So Heidick gets an extension cord. He cuts off the female end, strips it down so that only the hot wire is exposed, and will touch this wire while the male end of the plug is inside a wall socket, to either with a woman's skin or to their chains, causing a brief but intense electrical shock, depending on how long he holds it to them. Some of the women later claimed that Heidick would sometimes make them stand in a bucket of water while he did this, which further intensified the agony that they were under. This is going to lead to the next tragedy inside of Heidick's home. On the evening of March 18th, 1987, Gary Heidick decided that, with the exception of Josefina Rivera, the women were misbehaving and all needed to be punished. So he had all of the women get inside of the pit, and he had Josefina Rivera fill the pit with water using a hose. Afterwards, he had all of the women sit down inside of the pit, which he covered with plywood. The plywood, however, had been worked on since they first arrived in the house, with air holes having been drilled into the top of it. And through one of these air holes, Heidick pulled the women's chains, which he wrapped around a pipe. And at this point, Heidick instructed Josefina Rivera to touch the exposed electrical wire to the women's chains one by one. The survivors later stated that while they couldn't see what was going on above them, they could see the electric wire as it slowly moved towards their chains, and they certainly felt it when it happened, all of them screaming in agony as they were maliciously tortured from above. And then the wire came into contact with Deborah Dudley's chain. Dudley was zapped. She cries out that he's killing me. And then she is zapped again. And then Dudley goes limp. Despite the fact that electrical current is pulsing through her body and she's spasming and twitching, the other two women can tell that Deborah Dudley is in a very dangerous position. They start to scream out to Heidek and Rivera for them to stop, that something is wrong, Dudley is not moving. Unbeknownst to the surviving women inside of the pit, Heidek had gone upstairs to get another electrical cord, as he no longer had heard Deborah Dudley screaming, so only Rivera heard this, as she was informed that Dudley was no longer moving, she was face down in the water, and that the other two women could feel no pulse. When Heidek returns, he's informed of this, and he doesn't believe it, until one of the women pushes the boards that are over their head out of the way and informs him that Deborah Dudley is dead, she's not moving. Heidek reportedly looks down in the hole and comments that Dudley is face down in the water, at which point he removes the other two women from the pit. The surviving women later stated that Heidek pulled Dudley's body from the pit, and the next thing they knew, they were coming to lying on the basement floor with their handcuffs having been removed and Heidek making them dog food sandwiches and saying to them that they should be glad that it wasn't one of them. After making these sandwiches and before allowing the three surviving victims to eat, he informs Josefina Rivera that she is going to have to write a letter claiming her part in responsibility for Deborah Dudley's death. This she does. Later in court, she would state that she did this as she really had no other choice. She knew that if she went against him, he would more probably than not kill her, and that she was still looking to gain his trust enough that Heidek would put his defenses down and that she could escape. After doing this, Heidek had the other two women sign as witnesses. He signed it as well before he removed Rivera's cuffs and told her to go upstairs and put on a fresh pair of clothes. And this is really the beginning of the end for Gary Heidek. He now begins to trust Josefina Rivera, allowing her up into the house to wear clothing, to go out and dine with him and go shopping, after which they will come back to the house and have what he believes is consensual sex. She begins seeing Heidek having various sexual partners other than the women inside of the basement. Basically, he starts turning her into his captive girlfriend. If you believe Rivera, this was all by design. She had gained Heidek's complete trust and was now looking for an opportunity to get away from him long enough that she could contact law enforcement. If you believe the supporters of Gary Heidek, however, she was again a willing participant and was in fact looking for a way to get away from him so that she could begin blackmailing him. After Deborah Dudley dies, Gary Heidek leaves her body lying in the basement in full view of the two surviving victims,
The next day, he comes down, wraps her head and feet in plastic before putting her inside of the coffin freezer that's sitting in the basement. It's known that over the next few weeks, Heidek presented to the outside world an image that he was living a normal life, bringing Josefina Rivera with him pretty much wherever he went. He encountered Tony Brown at one point, who asked if he knew of Sandra Lindsay's whereabouts. Brown later told police that Heidek told him he had not seen Sandra and that he believed her family had her hidden away somewhere and were simply cashing her social security checks. While the body of Deborah Dudley continued to sit in the coffin freezer, this changed in the early morning hours of March 23rd, 1987. When Heidek loaded Dudley's body into the trunk of his Dodge Dart, and then, with Josefina Rivera in tow, drove to the Pine Barrens where he disposed of her body. According to Rivera, later that day, Heidek began discussing the need to find a replacement for Dudley. So that evening, he and Rivera found another young woman by the name of Agnes Adams, who was working as a prostitute. They got her into the car and then back to Heidek's home. All three of the individuals knew each other. Agnes and Rivera knew one another from working the streets, but also from working at a local strip club. While Heidek had picked Agnes up at least twice, once in January, where they went back to Heidek's home and were unable to gain access to a car parked in his driveway. And again in February, when he picked her up and she performed oral sex on him back at the Marshall Street house, after which he let her go. This night, seeing two individuals that she was at least somewhat acquainted with, Agnes Adams had no problem getting into the car. They drove back to Heidek's home. Heidek informed Rivera that she should lock the house up, went upstairs with Agnes Adams, where they proceeded to have sex, after which Heidek began to choke her before bringing her downstairs and handcuffing her with the other two women. Returning upstairs, he is reported to have told Rivera, quote, "That was easy. We should do that again tomorrow." The following day, March 24th, Rivera convinces Heidek that she really needs to go and see her children, convincing him that if he'll let her do this, she will bring a woman that she knows back to the house to be Heidek's sex slave. Eventually, he agrees to this, and that evening, the two of them set out with the idea that she's going to go see her kids, and then Rivera will return to Heidek with this friend of hers. At roughly midnight, Gary Heidek drops Josefina Rivera off at a gas station at 6th and Girard. She waits until Heidek leaves before making her way over to her boyfriend's apartment. Now, the boyfriend has simply assumed that Josefina has run off on him, and upon seeing her at the door, he doesn't want to have anything to do with her. However, Josefina starts telling him the story of what has happened, and by both of their accounts, her boyfriend doesn't believe anything that Josefina is telling him. This boyfriend would later state that Rivera told him about the beatings, the raping, the eating of dead bodies, the animals eating dead bodies, and that he did not believe her, and he still did not believe her, even after Heidek had gone to court and eventually prison for his crimes. And according to her boyfriend, he informed Rivera that they were going to go back to the house, and he was going to beat Heidek with a hammer, Rivera was able to talk him out of this plan, insisting that if they went back to the house, there was a very good chance that Heidek would kill the other girls being held captive. Now, what happens next is somewhat odd. The two leave this boyfriend's apartment and begin walking back towards the gas station. And somewhere along the way, her boyfriend decides that they need to call the cops and inform them of all of this. So they stop at a payphone. They call the police, and dispatch sends a unit over to their location. Rivera starts recounting her story to these officers, and they're not believing anything that she is telling them until Rivera showed the officers the marks on her wrist and ankles where Heidek had kept her chained up. At this point, the officers begin to believe Rivera's story. They want to bring her in for questioning. She informs them that Heidek is waiting for her at the gas station. So the officers phone. Another unit arrives to pick Rivera and her boyfriend up. Well, the first unit drives over to the gas station where they find a 1987 Cadillac sitting with the engine running and a man behind the wheel. They come up to the car, order Heidek out of the vehicle, and telling him that he's going to be arrested. Heidek seems to have been confused and is asking them the entire time if he had forgotten to pay his child support again. The officers say very little other than informing Heidek that the charges against him are much more serious than simply forgetting to pay his child support. Now we have Gary Heidek. He's in custody. Officers quickly converge on his home on Marshall Street. However, they have to wait for a search warrant to be signed, which is done in the very early morning hours. They then attempt to gain entrance to Heidek's home with the keys that he has given them. However, they are unable to, and if you'll recall, that is because Heidek had a very special key that he had cut in half, inserting one part of the key into the lock. He didn't give the officers this particular key, so they end up having to break down the front door to his house. Immediately, they are assailed with the stench of burnt human flesh. And as officers begin to fan out through the house, some of them make their way into the kitchen and to the refrigerator, where inside of the freezer they discover human remains. They also discover the broiling pan, which is blackened and charred, as well as the pot that victims would later state a human head had been boiled inside of. Downstairs in the basement, they discover the three remaining victims, who are all naked and believe the police to be another one of Heidek's cruel jokes. They're shying away from the officers till the officers are able to convince them that they aren't there to hurt them, but are there, in fact, to save them. Police find a lot of incriminating evidence around Gary Heidek's home, including human bones in the backyard. Something of this nature, as is often the case, was a novelty and was quickly sensationalized throughout the greater Philadelphia area. What had some nationwide coverage, it did not have the type of coverage that a crime of this magnitude would have in today's day and age, where the media is all about shock, awe, blood and guts, and the 24-hour news cycle, and something like this would be plastered all over the headlines until the next atrocity or outrage makes its way to the forefront. But in Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey. The headlines were filled with the typical gallows humor of this period of time that we're talking, calling Heidick the Rolls-Royce Reverend, saying that he was into stocks and bondage and other sorts of ribald statements. The media really went into a frenzy in these areas. And we would see something very similar not even a decade later when Jeffrey Dahmer would be arrested. And I have read some reports concerning this types of crimes where cannibalism plays a part, that the human mind is almost incapable of processing the horrors of that. And as a result, specifically in crimes where cannibalism is involved, it's almost a defense mechanism for individuals to make humorous jokes about it, dark humorous jokes to make light about it in an effort to process it, but also in an effort to downplay the horror and severity of it, as the majority of the human population is incapable of grasping, let alone understanding, one human being eating another. That's a mindset I myself have never been able to understand, as just the way my mind works, it's no different than a human being eating another cow. Everything that walks and breathes on this planet is an animal, and while it is horrific, to me, personally, it doesn't carry any more horror than it does with, you know, the eating of animal flesh. And that's just, again, that's the way I'm wired, and it could be also, too, that I am so desensitized to this stuff at this point after decades and decades of delving into crimes and viewing crime scene photos that this type of thing doesn't particularly faze me. But during this period of time, crimes involving cannibalism in the United States were exceedingly rare. They still are, although they do happen. So the media goes into this feeding frenzy. It's all over the place. Obviously, Heidick is not saying anything. He's going for an insanity defense. But also arrested in all of this is Tony Brown, who says that he participated in these crimes. Now, eventually, the charges against Brown were dismissed, but there has always been a lingering suspicion that Heidick may in fact have had co-conspirators involved in the crimes that he committed. Whether that is true or not, I cannot say. I highly doubt, personally, that Gary Heidick would have given this kind of information to others. However, the flip side of that is Tony Brown and many other individuals were in and out of his house constantly, and unless Heidick was able to completely keep the women silent, there's just no possible way they could not have known that something was going on in the basement. That being said, though, those who knew Heidick said that they saw no change in his behavior. Now, a number of Heidick's actions during the four-month period that he kept these women captive would be brought up in an effort to refute the idea that he was mentally incapable of knowing right from wrong during this period of time, which was the defense's contention that Gary Heidick was completely insane. First and foremost, he bought a brand new Cadillac in November of 1986, and the salesperson would often remark that whenever Heidick brought the car in for any sort of services, he and Heidick would pass the time talking about the stock market, something that Heidick was very knowledgeable about. He also returned to an outpatient program at the VA for those suffering from mental illness, and he continued this treatment up until the time of his arrest. He also had court appearances for child support with his estranged wife, Betty, and numerous sexual encounters with dozens of different women who he brought back to the home and whom he did not take captive. And when this case finally does go to trial, these are some of the things that the prosecution is going to present to try and prove that Gary Heidick was not, in a legal sense, insane during the period of time that he committed these crimes. Now, while they initially tried to find an impartial jury among those in Philadelphia, Heidick and his attorneys were able to get a change of venue insofar as jury selection went. And this actually began in June of 1988. And fairly quickly, they were able to select a jury of 12 with 6 alternates up in Pittsburgh, which is about as far away from Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania as you can get. Yes, many of these individuals had heard of Gary Heidick, but those who were selected assured that they could put aside what they may have heard or learned from the media to be an impartial jury. The trial officially began on June 20th of 1988, so roughly a year and a bit after Heidick's initial arrest, during which point he went through various psychological evaluations for both the defense and the prosecution. And despite the defense's best efforts to paint Gary Heidick as being insane, the jury does find Gary Heidick guilty of the crimes which he was charged for, which is murder in the first degree, rape, deprivation of civil liberties, kidnapping, false imprisonment. He's going to be sentenced to death. And this is something that Heidick and his attorneys are going to fight for years, trying to get the verdict overturned and get Heidick officially listed as being insane and therefore not culpable of his crimes. However, it's going to be to no avail. On July 6th, 1999, at the age of 55, after a last meal of 2 slices of cheese pizza and a cup of black coffee, Gary Heidick is going to be executed by lethal injection at the State Correctional Facility in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. And he is the last prisoner who was executed in the state of Pennsylvania. And while some of his victims have given interviews in the intervening years, for the most part, they have done their best to move on from Gary Heidick. However, Gary Heidick is an individual who has not moved on from our society, because something most people don't realize is the character Buffalo Bill from Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs novel, which was the second novel to feature Dr. Hannibal Lecter, was based in part on Gary Heidick. And despite that, it is still a fairly lesser-known case in the United States. Part of that undoubtedly is the fact that Heidick, who was arrested in 1987, would be overshadowed by individuals like Jeffrey Dahmer, who practiced cannibalism and whose crimes were on a much grander scale. In fact, there's no evidence to suggest that Gary Heidick himself partook in the eating of Sandra Lindsay's flesh, only that as a form of torture and punishment, he forced his remaining captives to consume the woman's body. That is the end of the Gary Heidick story. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Join me next week where we are going to be taking a look at a brand new case. Until next time, stay morbid.